AI isn't magic. It's just another tool that, if you apply it correctly into your defenses, will make you that much more stronger.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most important stories in the field with the help of our panel of expert practitioners. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski. Joining me today to break it all down, Chris Thomas, X-Force Global Lead of Technical Eminence and part of the Not the Situation Room podcast, Suja Viswasan, VP of Security Products, and Troy Betancourt, Global Partner and Head of X-Force. Our stories this week: the prophesied return of Scattered Spider and Friends, misconfigurations, hybrid Petya, and our panel shares dumb cybersecurity rules. But first, the AI vulnerability apocalypse. Sounds pretty scary. So I want to start us with a quick round-the-horn question today. What's the thing that worries you most about AI from a security perspective? Suja, let's start with you.
Well, AI is learning from us, right? The good, bad, and ugly. And then it is, when we start using it, then the bad and ugly are also part of it. And then you can use AI to exploit that as well. So that's what worries me.
Absolutely. Chris, how about you?
Well, I'm not really worried about AI, but I would say that defenders aren't really picking up AI quick enough and using it in their defenses.
Absolutely. And Troy, how about you?
For me, it's the rapid deployment of AI solutions across enterprises without a secure by design approach. You know, we've already seen the dangers where just assistants like copilots are exploited to, extract data from organizations. Now, imagine if that was fully autonomous agentic AI with no human oversight at all. Massive potential for risk.
Absolutely. And the reason I pose this question is because our very first story of this week has to do with a somewhat dire prediction from Gadi Evron, CEO of AI security company Nostic. Now, Gadi predicts that we are, and this is a direct quote, 6 months away from the upcoming vulnerabilities cataclysm. AI could make exploitation so fast it breaks cyber defenses down. Now, all three of you kind of touched on exactly what Gaddy's getting at here, right? Like Chris said, defenders are not really picking it up as fast as the attackers might be. Like Troy said, we're rolling it out very quickly, maybe before we even have security in place. And like Suja said, these things are learning from us and they can evolve faster than our security practices can evolve. So I wanted to start by asking whether you agree with the premise. Are we rushing headlong into AI disaster? And I want to start with you, Chris, because you brought this to my attention when it was first posted. I want to get your reactions to this prediction.
Well, I mean, attackers are using AI to automate vulnerable discovery, and they're already doing that. They've been doing that for a while. It's not a new thing. Now, the fear here, though, is that they're going to get so good at it, and it's going to be so fast, it's going to overwhelm us. But I really don't think that's going to happen. I mean, AI isn't magic. AI really still struggles with the nuances of like AI internals, memory layouts, bypassing mitigations. You still need human expertise at the end of the day to really exploit something, right? Now, the low end of the spectrum, the easy vulnerabilities, the easy exploits, AI is really good at that. The more expansive things, the things that require chaining of multiple exploits together, that becomes more and more difficult for AI to do. And so you still, not only is it AI, but the people still need to know how to use the AI to exploit these vulnerabilities. So the real risk here is scale, right? Can AI really easily flood the landscape with a bunch of low-end, easily exploited vulnerabilities? Maybe. But we have protections and mitigations in place, if properly deployed, to sort of solve that.
Absolutely. Troy, any thoughts on either this prediction or Chris's take?
I think there is some FUD there. 6 months, I think, is wildly unreasonable. That said, I think over time, AI tool attack tools will get better. You know, we've evaluated a bunch of the commercial tools that are available right now for use potentially in our own engagements, and have really found, to Chris's earlier point, they're really good at the easy stuff, the stuff that lets you scale, that takes a lot of human effort, scanning for vulnerabilities and picking which ones you want to exploit, but actually chaining them together like you do in red teaming, what the threat actors are really doing, they're just not there yet. And I don't think they're really close, to be quite frank. So I think it's a little mix of maybe his time frame's a little aggressive. I think he's right, if we roll out a couple years out.
Gotcha. And Suja, how about you? What are you thinking about this prediction?
Yes, AI is really good at figuring out what are the easy exploits. So similarly, are we adopting AI to figure these easy exploits ahead of time, right, as a defense mechanism so that these are not out there? The most complicated one, it's work in progress. But how do we adapt and then get that? Yes, and same thing with Troy, I agree. The timeline seems too aggressive for 6 months, but we need to be playing ahead of the game. There's no two ways about it.
As AI kind of stands, it's really good at the easy stuff. Some of that more complicated stuff, not quite there yet. I'm wondering, though, if you think that it will get there at some point. And I want to start with you, Troy, because you were saying, you know, maybe a year, 2 years out. Do you think it's actually going to reach that level in that time frame?
Prognosis is really hard to really stick to, right? I think we've all been wrong when we've made forecasts around AI. I think they'll get there, but keep in mind, right, that's a year or 2 years of defenders improving their own defenses, whether that's through security products building in AI or leveraging just better deployments of security technology across their enterprise.
Absolutely. Chris, I saw you start to maybe make a little reaction. Do you have thoughts on that one?
I mean, everybody talks about how the attackers are going to advance and get better by using AI, and they forget the defenders are also using AI, and they're going to advance right along with the attackers. So this, you know, vulnerability AI apocalypse thing, I'm not sure I would use such strong language, but the attackers are going to get better, but so are the defenders.
Gotcha. It's like Suja said, right? They learn the good, the bad, and the ugly. So it's really picking up all that stuff, and it's going to help both the defenders and the attackers. It depends on who is using it. That's something that comes up basically every time we record this show, right? All these tools depend on who's using it and what are they using it for. Now, I want to dig a little bit, though, into some of the specific kind of vulnerability trends that Gaddy calls out in his post, because I think they're worth discussing. And one of the first ones is this, and this is a quote again from the post. Vibe coding boosts velocity, but removes critical checks, producing insecure code at scale. And Troy, you had mentioned, you know, some of the co-pilot stuff and the coding assistant stuff we've seen so far. So I wanted to get your take. Do you agree that vibe coding can kind of introduce some of these vulnerabilities by removing critical checks?
Oh, absolutely. We've already seen examples of that. The T app, if everyone recalls that was in the news a few months back. It was supposedly a vibe coded app. I can't say it had poor security, it had zero security. And that was a really great example. And I think we'll see more of that. You know, my concern, as I mentioned, was development without security being as part of it, like enterprise development, but vibe coding is even worse, right? That is the true wild west of no security in development. So yeah, it is definitely concerning.
Suja, did you have any thoughts on that? Because I know in the past we've talked quite a bit about vibe hacking, vibe coding, vibe security, as you called it. So I want to get your takes on the risks of vibe coding.
So somebody who doesn't know anything about software can build an app today. I think that's what happened with the app that Troy was talking about. Because you cannot fix something that you don't know that you are causing. So definitely it does introduce. That is why when people say, hey, this is a co-pilot, or it works alongside a senior engineer who knows what they're doing. If you have a tool and you don't know what you're doing, of course you can poke your eye with it. And that's what happened there. So we need to be educating everybody to say, hey, this is a tool and how are you going to use it? What are the guardrails? So that is why these tools need to evolve so that the security becomes part of it rather than after the fact. I think this is something that security needs to be baked in, not bolted in later.
I like that you point out, you know, that the tool can poke your own eye out if you don't know what you're doing with it, right? Because again, it's not just who's using it, but how you're using it, right? So even if you're using it for ostensibly benign reasons, if you're not doing it right, you know, you'll shoot your eye out. Chris, do you have any takes on vibe coding and where it fits into the cybersecurity landscape?
We're looking at the LLMs and the models that we're using today as they stand today, right? These things are constantly evolving, constantly getting better, constantly adding new data. And so as the need for secure coding becomes more apparent, those features will be built into the newer models, right? As customers demand, hey, if I'm going to do vibe coding, I need it to be secure. They're going to demand that the coding that's output is secure. So yeah, we have a problem today. I think that will become less of a problem tomorrow.
Got it. And so, yeah, again, we all kind of agree here that it sounds like anyway, that this the 6 month time frame, a little aggressive. There are certainly some issues, but, you know, we got to keep up with what's happening here. And so I want to kind of end this segment on a kind of future forward looking take, right? What kinds of advice would you have for organizations right now who are maybe a little bit worried about this kind of talk about an AI vulnerability cataclysm? How can they start to position themselves for the best security in the future with this stuff? Let's start with Suja on that.
The bigger thing is for doing a POC, it's great. So start with whatever you have and then learn from it. As Troy mentioned earlier, when you're deploying it for production, make sure the right set of guardrails are set. Don't jump into it thinking. I believe that, especially for development purposes, task-based, I need this task completed. AI is really, really good. If you want to build a scalable enterprise app, then you need to be thinking about all the security. Are the vendors providing it, or they're expecting you to provide it? So make sure that you understand it and then go from there. Instead of jumping into the bandwagon, oh my God, I can replace all my engineers with vibe coding. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. You got to keep that human in the loop, right? Troy, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'd like to expand upon what Sue just said. First of all, it's the shared responsibility model. I think a lot of clients that rushed to cloud years ago and then found out, oh, the cloud provider wasn't responsible for security like I thought, were surprised. Same thing with AI. But I think stepping back a little, it's really security fundamentals. AI adds a little bit to it, but it's role-based access control. It's ensuring that your APIs, or in this case, maybe A2A or MCP communications are secured. It's making sure that the front-end app you're developing that's going to leverage the AI uses best coding practices, secure by design. So really, it's about doing all of that, understanding your assets, your data flows, ensuring they're protected. Unfortunately, history has shown we haven't been that good about that across the enterprise hygiene from a security perspective, and AI is now just rapidly exposing that.
I like that you brought up that kind of analogy to the cloud apps, because you're foreshadowing something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, which is the persistent issue with misconfigurations in cloud apps. But before we get to that, Chris, what are your thoughts on how organizations can best position themselves to kind of deal with this cataclysm?
Well, you know, like Troy said, focus on the fundamentals, right? Those have not changed. Just because we have a brand new shiny thing over here, the fundamental security practices that we've been using for the last 20, 30 years still apply. AI isn't magic. It's just another tool that if you apply it correctly into your defenses will make you that much more stronger.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about security is that you do have this set of bedrock principles that you can kind of adapt and apply to almost, you know, every situation. And rather than getting distracted by that shiny new object, you just remember, keep that stuff in mind. All right, let's move on to our next story, which is involving a cast of characters that we have seen time and time again on this show. Scattered Spider, Shiny Hunters, they are back. Now, anybody who listened to our last episode would know that we discussed the supposed retirement announcement of Shiny Lapsus Hunters, and our panel unanimously declared that it was absolutely bunk. And it turns out that they were right, and they were so right, in fact, that it was the very same day our episode went live that they were back in business. And you know what? If anything annoys me, is we couldn't even have a week. We couldn't even have a week without them. It takes all the fun out of prognosticating when they just show up that day. But anyway, my hurt feelings aside, they're back and they're doing some new stuff. And so before we get into some of the new things I want to discuss, I would like to get some reactions to the return of Scattered Spiders and Shiny Hunters. Suja, how are you feeling about this?
Once you know that you can get away with things, you're going to keep on trying. I think that's what it is.
Makes perfect sense. Chris, what about you?
I mean, once a criminal, always a criminal, right? I mean, that's where the money is. That's how they make their money. They're not going to abandon that just because for whatever, right? Unless the money goes away.
Unfortunately, the money has not dried up. Troy, what about you?
Well, hopefully this doesn't violate any brand permission, but shocked Pikachu faced here. Did anybody expect that they were really going to retire?
I think that the shocked Pikachu meme is an especially apt one here, given that Shiny Hunters does take its name from a Pokemon reference. So we got some synergy going on here, all right? So yeah, obviously, nobody is surprised. Everyone's like, of course they're back. We all saw this coming a mile away. But what's interesting to me is that, again, they're doing some new stuff in this round, at least stuff we haven't seen them doing before. They're targeting more financial institutions, which that's obvious. And they're doing it, though, with a lot of LLM orchestrated vishing. By that, I mean they've got operators sitting with LLMs and using them to kind of play out some of these vishing calls that they're making. And they'll even use generated, synthesized voices to kind of operate on the calls to pose as certain people. It sounds like very sophisticated stuff. And what they often do is they begin by calling the target's IT help desk and claiming to be an employee who is locked out of their account and asking to reset their password. And the reason I mention this specifically is because I had a conversation a long time ago with Stephanie Carruthers of IBM X-Force, and she had mentioned that when she does social engineering engagements, the one trick that works almost every single, actually not even almost, she said every single time they do it is the IT help desk password reset ploy. It works every time they do it. And so it's a little scary to me that they're using this ploy and they've got LLMs doing it. So I wanted to ask sort of the panel, this AI-powered vishing, have you seen this kind of stuff before? Let's start with you, Troy.
Yeah, we've seen a little bit. You see it in open source intelligence about some of these groups. It's not really a surprise, especially the Scattered Spider group. They're not known for really being technically advanced, right? They've always focused more on the social engineering side, which is the easiest one where you can operationalize that with support from LLMs and AI. So to me, it makes sense, right? They are finding value in using AI to make them more effective in what they do.
Sujit, what about you? Any thoughts on this LLM vishing? Have you seen stuff like this before?
It becomes very easy to personalize and then go from there, because previously you have to do a lot of work to get all these information. Now with LLMs, it becomes much easier to make it very personalized to people. So I do see why they are doing it, because it's like coming from me to you, right? You're going to the IT department about an employee. This is not somebody coming from outside. So it's very, very believable. So I totally see this happening.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? It makes spear phishing super easy because you can have the LLM gather that information too. And so many people post things online openly on their, you know, social media accounts. That makes the attacker's jobs really easy. I remember even in the pre-LLM days, there was some stat about how like attackers could spend 45 minutes on Google and get all the information they need for a spear phishing attack. Imagine how much shorter it is now that we've got LLMs doing this stuff. Chris, what about you? Any thoughts on this tactic?
It's not new, right? We've seen vishing before, audio and video. So that's not a new thing. I think what it does do is highlights the importance of something like two-factor authentication, right? Or confirmation of identity through a second channel. These are standard basic practices that companies can use to defeat the sort of vishing and phishing attacks that we see today.
Yeah, talk about a kind of simple solution to a high-tech problem, right? You got fake voices, AIs, all this kind of stuff. Throw a second factor on there, folks. Make sure you got that stuff set up. Set up a passkey. Do something, right? The other thing, though, that I found interesting was that they're not just doing this LLM orchestrated vishing. They're also actively trying to recruit employees of the organizations they're targeting to their side, right? And as we've seen this specifically with Shiny Hunters, I'm not sure if Scattered Spider is doing it, but the overlap, it's hard to tell where one begins, one ends. But anyway, Shiny Hunters has been actively trying to recruit employees of the organizations they're targeting. Have you seen this kind of thing before, and does it work? Troy, I'm going to throw to you first.
Yeah, we've actually seen a few articles in the news. And then for anybody that's following the Calm, which is a wider group of cyber criminals, generally skew younger, Scattered Spider, Shiny Hunters apparently came out of there, as well as Lapsus. They've been doing that for a while. They were doing that for SIM swapping. They would find mobile provider employees and pay them money to do it. And then they shifted away from that. It's not a surprise. The insider threat aspect is really the most interesting thing to me about this. You know, an insider is one of the most difficult threats to really protect against, because they've already got permissions, they've got roles, and as long as they're staying within the behavior you'd expect, it's very hard to identify that they're doing something like that. Now then, couple that with the unstable state of world affairs, employment and cost of living challenges in many nations, and now a really continued decline in the strength of the employer-employee relationship or social contract over the last few years, and I really think it's a ripe target for exploitation.
That's a really good point, right? There are a lot of social forces that make right now, it might be a pretty good time to go recruit some of those disgruntled folks, right? Chris, your thoughts on this kind of tactic. Have you seen it before? Does it work?
Yeah, again, I mean, this has been around for years, especially as Troy mentioned, with mobile phone companies, insiders getting paid. And again, the social aspects, economics out there mean that you have very low paid employees with very high levels of access and are very susceptible to a little bit of extra cash. And the criminal element has a lot of extra cash so that they can make even more money. So yeah, I'm actually a little surprised that the insider threat isn't a bigger issue today than it actually is.
Be careful what you wish for there. Sujo, what are your thoughts?
There is still some basic human decency that people still have. That's what is preventing us from doing it. But the challenge is the social economic pressure that is being there. And Troy, you talked about it, nailed it really well. In the last 5 years, we have seen the loyalty, the corporate employee-employer loyalty is also eroding away. And all this ad becomes an easy bait. For somebody who's in the fence, it's easier to jump one way or the other. So I'm not surprised, but it's a reality that we need to work on. One of the things that we have been thinking about security as a person having an access, right? It's about workflow. In order for you to do a workflow, do you need access? And once you're done, just enough access, and then it goes away. I think we need to be rethinking how, at least we are thinking about, how do we rethink security, even identity and access management?
Absolutely. And again, basic human decency. I like that you brought that up, that so often the human factor is our first line of defense. And that factor can just be, you know what, I don't want to sell out my employer like this. But something that you brought up, Troy, and I want to go back to this, is that it can be extremely hard to tell when you have an insider threat, right? Especially if they're just using the permissions they already have, but for like illegitimate purposes. And so I was wondering if you have thoughts on, what do you look out for as an organization, right? How do you catch these kinds of insider threats? Is it possible?
I think it is. There's been a lot of work that's been taken from sort of the counterintelligence space and then brought over into security products. There are some of the standards, you know, look for activity outside of normal working hours. Look for potential remote access from not approved places, you know, in the event they shared their credentials, let's say, data flows that don't seem to be accurate with what you'd expect the employee to be doing. But I don't think anyone's really cracked it because it is so hard. It's so independent by the individual, their role, to Suja's point, what their necessary access is. You know, if it's an admin especially, it gets so difficult because many threat actors live off the land, as they call it, using binaries or other tools that you'd expect to see on a system and that they'd use in their daily basis. So how do you really find what is anomalous there? It's very challenging. There's a whole product space around this, and quite frankly, it hasn't lived up to expectations, I think, for many security buyers.
No, that was fantastic, and I absolutely agree with that, Troy. And I wanted to throw to Chris, if you have any thoughts there as well, anything to add about how you can kind of catch some of these insider threats when they blend in so well.
Yeah, like Troy said, it's really about continuously monitoring your network and trying to identify people based on traffic patterns, which is difficult. Right? It really requires some specialized software. AI can actually help here, depending on what packages you're using. But it's difficult, especially with your more senior employees with higher access who are, you know, generally need to get into all places of the business. It becomes more and more difficult to sort of to find them and isolate them based on their traffic alone.
Absolutely. And Suja, your thoughts?
I think pretty much many products now incorporate user behavior analytics, right? Because that's very much so what you can say what the anomalies are. So we talked about the difficult things about AI, because today with AI, we can get to those answers much faster, which is false positive, which is a happening, which might be a threat, and then try to catch it. But you cannot definitely catch it all because it's constantly evolving, especially like what Troy was talking about. If you're an admin, you do have blanket access to everything. At that point, if you are that person, how do we find out? That's a tricky one. The edge cases are the tricky one.
Thank you for that. And let's move on to our next story. Misconfigurations. To put it meanly, I called it when getting hacked is your own dang fault. In a new blog post, researchers from the Wiz Cloud Security Platform discuss three instances of application misconfigurations allowing threat actors to do real damage. And just this morning, I was reading a new report about a massive mal spam attack that used 13,000 misconfigured routers to create a botnet to send just a bunch of phishing emails. And all they did was exploit default security settings that were never changed, right? People just didn't change the default password, so you could get right in there and do it. So this is a real persistent problem that keeps on happening. And some of the common misconfigurations that Wiz called out specifically were public exposure, right? Databases that shouldn't be public are exposed to the public-facing internet, not changing those default credentials like we just talked about, and giving people excessive permissions, which I think a lot of this ties very much into exactly what we were talking about with that insider threat angle as well, right? The difficulty of getting those permissions right. So, Troy, I want to start with you first, because all the way back in that first segment, you were bringing up this idea of app misconfigurations. Do you see this kind of thing a lot, app misconfigurations causing security problems for organizations?
I've been doing this a while, and over 20 years ago, I led the government's investigation into the largest hack of U.S. government systems to that date, and it was blank admin passwords on systems exposed to the internet. Can't say much has changed, except Microsoft doesn't allow blank admin passwords on their OS anymore, which is nice. But this is what keeps us in business from an incident response perspective, is if you can socially engineer passwords or buy them on the internet, or somebody misconfigures something, you don't have to break in. You don't have to be a technical wizard. You just have to look for the open doors and walk right through them. So I think we're going to continue to see this. Hopefully, as AI does develop and get better, it'll do better identifying this, because it's a scale problem. Enterprises are huge. They're complex. There's lots of moving parts that change, and humans just can't grapple with that. So I'm hopeful that AI, as it progresses, will become a really good defensive mechanism for us in this space.
Yeah, I think, not allowing those blank admin passwords, that's one of those dumb rules, right? One of those things you got to stop doing because someone was using it. but yeah, so Chris, your thoughts on this take. Have you seen misconfigurations causing problems for organizations before?
Yeah, I mean, misconfigurations are as old as security, right? You click the wrong button, you set the wrong thing, and you open the door. I think what we're seeing, though, or what was happening, is that as companies try to save money, they're kind of cutting some of their security personnel and pushing the security tasks off onto the regular IT people. And that's fine, except the IT people don't really know what buttons to click to make things secure. And they just want to click the right buttons to make things work. And making things work and making things secure are two different things, which is where you come up with a lot of misconfigurations. And that's not even getting into the complex stuff where you have a chain of misconfigurations that worked in concert to open up a hole. This is where, you know, just one thing, because the IT guy wanted to make it work, and wasn't able to actually make it secure and work.
Absolutely. You know, often there's that tension, right, between just making the thing work and making sure it works securely. And we don't always do that second part. Sudra, your thoughts?
It's a tough one, because when you are developing, and if you hit a problem, the first thing is, let me turn off security and see if it works. Okay? That's how we debug. And then when you deploy it, did you turn it on back again? It's a very simple human error, sometimes very unintended, and then it happens. So it's extremely important that the tools are available to do proper checks and balances. We are cutting costs everywhere, so let's reduce the humans, let's have the tools do it. Earlier mentioned, the tools are as good as the good, bad, and ugly of human. They can miss things too, just like us. So who's policing the police to make sure things are working fine? But then it keeps the security professionals in business, like Troy said. I think that's what keeps the business going.
Silver lining, right? There's a job for us to do. Troy, something that you had said, right, was that part of the issue with these misconfigurations is scale, right? There can be so many of them in a massive enterprise with all these apps configured and set up. And so I was wondering if it's harder to find some of these misconfigurations maybe than it is to find like your typical, you know, vulnerability, right? When there's some kind of bug or flaw in the code, is it harder to surface these things where it's like, it's not a bug in the code, it's just someone clicked the wrong button?
Yeah, I think it is, because, I don't know if it's harder. In fact, I would think it might be easier from a threat actor perspective. Trying to find insecure code requires a lot more skill than trying to find an open door. And I think the scale is much larger. There's only so many applications being deployed, whereas there are so many different access points across hyperscalers. So I think misconfigurations are probably a greater threat than insecure software, quite frankly. And I think that goes to Space Rogue's earlier point. If IT's responsibility is to make things work, and they're the ones that are deploying these or deploying, whether it's applications or hyperscalers, et cetera, you're going to have less security attuned folks making these decisions, which is likely to cause more misconfigurations.
Absolutely. Misconfigurations can be a bigger problem than vulnerabilities. I want to see, Suja, do you agree with that? Do you feel like that's true?
It is definitely true, because you don't, at least vulnerabilities, you know these are the vulnerabilities and everything else. You see a report and make a conscious decision to ship something with vulnerability because you know that this cannot be accessed for whatever reason that you might have. But with misconfiguration, you don't even know. How do you fix things that you don't know? I think I do see that it's a bigger problem. And these misconfigurations are easily detectable using AI today. But on the other hand, it can also be, that is what a lot of companies are working on. I think Wiz talking about it, IBM Concert talking about is, how do we make sure that there are checks and balances on figuring out these misconfiguration earlier so we don't really ship it?
Absolutely. And Chris, what about you? How do you feel about the kind of misconfiguration versus vulnerability thing?
I'm going to say the same thing I said with the insider threat. I'm surprised it's not a bigger issue. It's really is a big deal. And I think there probably are more misconfigurations out there than we realize. They're just not being exploited yet.
Absolutely. And so how do we start to be more vigilant about misconfigurations? Is there a way to do that? Chris, I'll start with you again right there. Do you have any thoughts on how organizations can maybe have fewer of these things?
Well, we go back to fundamentals, right? And we look at inventory. And people laugh when I say this sometimes because inventory is what we did back in 1998, making sure we knew what we had. But if you do your inventory properly and you know what you have and you know how it's configured, that's part of the inventory, right? Back to the fundamentals, checking all your stuff. And it can be difficult when you're talking about a global enterprise with millions of endpoints and thousands of routers and whatnot. But it's you got to do it. And as Suja's point, this is where AI can be very helpful in continuously monitoring your endpoints and your network devices and checking that configuration and making sure the configuration file matches what it's supposed to be.
Absolutely. Suja, anything to add there?
I think, one of the things that we're talking about, Selenium Grid, where, hey, do not put it up there in production. Like, we are in tech space. Can we build some things that if you have this, you cannot deploy? Like, how do we make sure that we protect ourselves some, like, easy, stupid mistakes? I think that's where the Microsoft one, where, okay, you cannot have blank passwords anymore. So then people came with admin. That's a different problem that we need to now solve. But at least we are making progress, not perfection, but we need to keep making progress with these things.
Absolutely. One small step at a time. Troy, any thoughts on your end?
I think Suja and Chris covered it pretty well. To me, this is the area that I think AI really has a chance of making a near-term difference. There are many ways to misconfigure stuff, but I think that's somewhat limited, whereas the ability to create insecure apps through development, it's almost limitless the ways you could do that. And AI does well with these large-scale problems. And at the risk of doing a product pitch, IBM Consulting's actually built out tools for this already that they brought to market to help do it. And we know competitors are doing the same.
Absolutely. The limitless potential to make bad apps. I like ending on that. Let's move on to our next story. Hybrid Petya adds a new twist to an old ransomware. Now, I would assume that you folks remember that name, Petya. It was a ransomware that made some waves in the mid-2010s, and especially NotPetya, which came out in 2017 and was responsible for one of the most destructive cyber attacks in history, causing over $10 billion dollars in damages. So $10 billion, that's a B, against a host of organizations throughout Europe. Now, recently, new ransomware samples discovered on VirusTotal appear to be a copycat of these infamous strains, but with some new tricks. So researchers have dubbed them Hybrid Petya. Now, we don't know if it is actually being used in the wild yet. No one's actually seen that. And it could be just more proof of code, somebody toying around, messing with stuff. But still, to me, it's a little bit concerning to see that name Petya pop up again. So let's start with just some basic reactions to this news. Chris, how are you feeling about seeing that?
Well, it's not the first copycat of NotPetya that we've seen. I doubt it will be the last. I think the biggest thing I was reading about this one is that it adds a vulnerability or takes advantage of UEFI boot, which not the first time we've seen malware do that either. So yeah, this is important. We need to pay attention, but not novel.
Got it. Sujay, how about you?
Yes, not novel. And you have to have the basic hygiene, right? Like, again, it's like wash your hands. Like, don't touch, don't click on links that you don't know. Don't pick up the phone if you don't know the people. Like, all those basic hygiene is what is needed there.
Absolutely. And Troy, how about you?
Yeah, I'll pivot off of something Space Rogue said earlier. I'm surprised we're not seeing more of this. If I was a threat actor, this is where, now granted, it's harder to do. Maybe that's why we're not seeing it. But most of our security tools focus on the operating system, the user space, or applications, right? That's really where we focus, or the cloud. They don't touch the BIOS or the UEFI. There's almost nothing there that monitors that or protects against that, yet it is writable and accessible. So that's a huge problem. And then if you mess up the MFT, which they're doing, which is what is basically the underlying file system that allows the system to work, now you can't even boot the system. So how do you fix it? Well, most tools can't do that remotely. So now on a widely dispersed enterprise, you have to have people going around with boot CDs or boot thumb drives and booting these systems up to fix it. So the ability to recover is very limited in many organizations. And to Chris's earlier point, I don't know why we don't see more of this.
Yeah, I'm glad you both brought up that UEFI kind of system compatibility, right? And the way that it can write to that partition. And now I could try to explain that, but I am nowhere near as seasoned in this field as you folks are. So I'd love to throw it to the experts to talk a little bit about why that particular thing is troubling and why that caught attention. Chris, do you want to maybe say some words on that?
Well, if you look at UEFI as sort of like the BIOS of days gone by, right? It's the code in the hardware that controls the system. And if you can control that, you control the machine, regardless of what operating system or security stuff you have on top of it, because it's below that, right? Now, we do have security things in place that we can use to protect the UEFI, right? TPM, Trusted Platform Module or something, Secure Boot also. And believe it or not, manufacturers issue patches for UEFI on occasion, and almost nobody patches that ever. So if you keep up with that and monitor your firmware integrity, you can sort of try to protect yourself against this sort of attack.
Yeah, so this is another lesson why you should patch your dang systems. When the patches come out, patch them, please. Sujay, any thoughts on advice for organizations in terms of what they should do to kind of set themselves up to combat a threat like this one?
See, this is a tough one, like, because it's in the OS boot, not even OS level, right? It's a hardware level. It's like what we saw with CrowdStrike. We couldn't fix it because each machine needs to be addressed separately to make sure that you're fixing it. So this is the same level of challenge that you will have when you get in there. So keeping things up to date and making sure apparently all the phishing education and everything doesn't work as much as it should. So I'm at loss to how do you get people to use common sense and not go and then click on this and then get that going. For that, making sure that things are, there is secure boot. You're not able to go mess with it. Like, what are the guardrails that you can put? It's not even a firewall thing because you're going to the hardware directly to not get to that level of access.
If you can figure out how to make people use common sense, you will crack a mystery of the human condition that nobody has cracked
Agreed.
Yet, Suja. So Agreed. Get to work
I,
on
it
that
just
one.
Just have a name, which is very common, but it's not at all common.
And Troy, any thoughts on your end in terms of, you know, security practitioner takeaways here? You know, what do you do to set yourself up in the face of a threat like this?
Yeah, so I think fundamentals, let's step back. If you're a business, what is your minimum viable business? What do you need to keep the business running so you can prioritize on that? All of those systems should have immutable backups stored elsewhere so you can quickly restore them and get them functioning. When you get to the end user, you know, workstation type of stuff, don't store anything on the local system. Or if you do, at least have, you know, Box, OneDrive, whatever that cloud-based storage is. So, you know, maybe their laptops don't work anymore, but maybe they can continue limping along with their phones while you fix things, right? Again, try to figure out what is it going to take to keep this place running until we get everything fixed and take that approach. Don't just layer more and more and more technologies and security stuff as much as we'd love to sell you that. Really take a holistic view around your entire enterprise and what it means. It should be part of really your risk management program or your disaster program and not strictly an IT problem.
Resiliency becomes top of mind for everybody along with security, because it's not a matter of question. If, when it happens, how do you make sure that you are resilient?
Moving on then to our final topic for this episode, something a little more fun, right? Anybody who tuned in to the last episode will know we talked about dumb rules you got to put in place because somebody did something dumb. Maybe dumb's mean, but you know what we're talking about. We all have dumb moments. The example that we were talking about specifically was, you know, the do not eat label on a silica gel packet, right? And you had to put that on there because somebody ate that packet at some point. And so that got me thinking about what are the dumb cybersecurity rules you've seen instituted or that you maybe have instituted yourself because someone did something maybe a little bit dumb, like those blank admin passwords Troy had mentioned. So I'd love to give everybody just a moment to share their story with us. And let's start with Chris. You got anything for us?
I got a couple. I'll give you probably one that my biggest pet peeve is people or companies, organizations that actually fire people for clicking on links. I think that's dumb and stupid and is a failure of your education model in your organization and not a failure of the employee for clicking on something because that's their job, to click on links. That's what they get paid for. They're opening resumes, they're opening POs or whatever. You're paying them to click on links. And if they click on the wrong one, oh my God, you got to fire them. No, don't do that. That is, it's really, you're blaming the user for your own poor security implementation.
Ooh, I like that one. Very good. It's kind of the opposite, right? Instead of don't click on things and understand that that's part of people's job. They're clicking on things. You just got to teach them, you know, help them click on fewer bad things, you know? I like that one. Suja, what about you? Any thoughts on dumb cybersecurity rules?
The thing is the passwords are like not 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Like making sure that people are able to think through it or in those cases use passkeys. What are the other options to go do it rather than your birthday, your wife's birthday, like whatever that comes into mind, that is the main rule.
Absolutely. And Troy, how about you?
Well, I already gave up my admin one, so I'm not sure there, Matt. You know, one thing I'd like to sort of pivot on it, because, you know, to Chris's point, the person's wrong or they're dumb. I get a lot of calls from, you know, non-technical family members or friends asking, I get an email, what should I do, right? And rather than telling them what to do or telling them they're stupid for falling for it, I just try to walk them through it. You know, it's from the bank. Well, do you bank with that bank? No. Well, then you can assume it's a spam. Yes, I do. Okay, but is this the email address you have associated with your bank? No, it's not. Okay, it's spam. And really just walk them through that common sense we talked about. It's not common for non-technical people. They shouldn't be expected to. So we need to educate them to really work through the problem solving around it. And usually by the second or third question, they're like, I was a dummy. I shouldn't have called you. And I'm like, no, keep calling. That's what I'm here for.
No, absolutely. And I think it's important to point out, right, that like every single one of us, no matter how tech savvy we can fall for those kinds of things, right? The whole conversation we had that sort of sparked this topic last time was talking about how a very accomplished developer on NPM, somebody who's responsible for 20 packages, so somebody who knows what they're doing, they got hit by a phishing email at the wrong time and they clicked the link that they shouldn't have clicked. So anybody this can happen to. And again, teaching people that, you know what, I like this idea of teaching people it's okay to you know, call, ask questions. Don't feel bad about it. There's no such thing as a dumb question. We all make mistakes. And if we can be that common sense for other people, then the world is a better place for that. All right. I thank you all so much then. That's all the time that we have for today. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Suja. Thank you, Troy. Thank you to the audience at home for spending time with us. Make sure to subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there and practice that common sense a little bit.